The magic time has flipped over on our digital phones, and we're excited to have so many of you here today. This is a session number 351, Author Meets Critics, mostly responding to Mike Quinn's Mormon Hierarchy, Wealth, and Corporate Power. I'm going to put in a plug here that I also hope that it turns into, in many ways, a celebration of Mike and how much he means to so many of us, how much he's meant to this community, and things like that. So So at the end, when our two panelists and Mike have done, any kinds of questions are fine. Maybe if you have really specific questions about the book, maybe come up first, and then we'll just see what the rest of our time together leads to. So, of course, everybody, silence these babies. You'll be embarrassed if you don't. You know it's going to be recorded, so if you do come up to the microphone, I think you can't do anything about your voice maybe going places, so always remember that stuff. I hope while you're here at Sunstone, you're buying books from Benchmark Books, including Mike's book. We have some signature books people, the publisher of the book here, and they'll also be happy to talk with you about anything that they're doing. But, you know, Sunstone needs your support, and all the vendors and everybody here, it just means a ton when you kind of do those sorts of things and not just rely on getting your information from Google or Wikipedia. Let's talk about this session. In 2017, Michael Quinn released his third and final installment in his Mormon Hierarchy series, Wealth and Corporate Power, published by Signature Books. This volume examines both the personal wealth of church leaders and the finances of the institutional church. The LDS Church brings in billions of dollars annually in tithing donations, as well as revenue from business endeavors. The church spends much of its annual intake to maintain existing buildings, construct new ones, and to support members in impoverished countries. In this session, panelists examine and respond to Quinn's findings and conclusions, and Mike Quinn himself, because they love him. Joe Geisner will speak to us first. I got to know Joe in the mid-90s, and what it says here, he is a Mormon history enthusiast who collects rare Mormon books. And I met him during my 6 years of working with Benchmark Books. He's one of my favorite people. He's kind, he's brilliant, just a wonderful guy. He's published in Journal of Mormon History, Sunstone, John Whitmer Association Journal, Irrantum, which is the Association for Mormon Letters. He's been a guest on podcasts such as Naked Mormonism. If you don't know what that is, look it up. It's pretty interesting. He did do it in the buff, I hear. Yeah. It was radio, so who knows? It might have been true. Maybe, were you remote? Maybe you didn't have pants on or something?
No, that was for Year of Polygamy.
Oh. Ouch. Some of you on the tape, I hope you heard that. That's funny. We're having a good time. Yeah, he's been on Year of Polygamy. He and his wife own and operate two care facilities for disabled folks in North California. He's wonderful. I know you'll love him. Christine Rossetti kind of came into the Sunstone universe 4 or 5 years ago. Yeah, I got to know her right away, and she's just a fascinating, wonderful person. She is not LDS, and she's a doctoral candidate in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of California, Riverside, where she's emphasizing her dissertation and things is Mormonism and spiritualism and alternative forms of Mormon religious practice. She's presented here on that material before. You might want to look it up because it's truly fascinating stuff. And anybody that thinks all Mormons are alike, I mean, we know it from here. Christine's found some very, very interesting, wonderful people. In 2017, she was awarded the Mormon Studies Fellowship at the Tanner Humanities Centers at the University of Utah. I think you'll really enjoy Christina. Michael Quinn, of course, earned his PhD at Yale University in 1976. He taught American Social History at BYU from 76 until 88. The Hierarchy series that we've talked about, Origins of Power in 94, Extensions of Power in 97, and now Corporate Power. We were all a little bit ticked that it took 20 years, but we were glad when it came out. Mike's an independent scholar. It is not a lot of institutional support there, right, Mike? No. Think about that. In 2016, the Mormon History Association Award gave him the honorary Leonard J. Arrington Award for Distinguished and Outstanding Service to Mormon History. What a good group we have, and we're going to have a great time. So we'll go till 3:30. Joe, you ready? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Dan. I have agonized over this. I am not an economist. I'm not an accountant. My wife and I do run a business. We have made it exist. We've kept it afloat. And so that's about the only qualification I have when it comes to business part. But what I do have, I think, and hopefully it's beneficial, is that I've had a very long-term relationship, friendship with Mike. And I read a lot. Matter of fact, my wife says I read way too much. So I was thinking, if you wouldn't mind, and if I get shaking head, no, I won't do it, but just to talk a little bit about that long-term relationship, just to give you a glimpse of what it is to get to know Mike Quinn. Would that bother you? Okay. I met Mike the first time in 1981. I had just come back from my mission that June or July, I think it was July, and I had returned back to BYU. And sometime during that fall semester, in the Daily Universe, had an article about this history professor who had worked at the Church History Library, Church Archives at the time, and he had received his doctorate from Yale, and he was speaking on the Joseph Smith III blessing. That came out when I was on my mission, and we had had a lot of angst over that when we would teach people, because it was in the news. And so there was a lot going on over that. And so I wanted to go hear Mike. And I remember I was sitting, it was in the Harris Fine Arts Center, and I was sitting in the middle row, about three or four rows back. And this young woman that was in front of me asked if I knew Mike. And I said, no, I'd never met him. And she said, he was my seminary teacher. And Mike is able to tackle the hard questions and help us through and understand those. There's a bit of irony in that, because that is exactly what G. Homer Durham said when Mike was doing the new plural marriage. And Mike had requested to see some confidential and first presidency minutes that were closed to research. And G. Homer Durham, in giving Mike access, had said that Mike has gotten us through some really difficult questions, and let's hope he can do it again on this. I would see Mike on campus, and he always had a smile. I'm just a sophomore, young kid, and he always had a smile, and he'd always stop and say hi and talk to me. He was always so kind. I got involved in Sunstone. One of my former Sunday school teachers, Lynn Whitesides, was the Lindsay Hansen Park of that day. And so I would come to Sunstone, and Mike was presenting then. He lived in New Orleans at the time, I believe, but he would come and present. And the first thing I would do when I'd get here is try and find Mike to see what he was doing and how he was doing. And he'd always take the time to talk to me, which was incredible. Again, I always thought how amazing that is. And one of the conversations I recall is I said to him, in reading the Succession article that was published in BYU Studies, I said, the amount of courage that took for both you and BYU Studies to publish that, Because Mike showed that Brigham Young was not the only successor. Now, I don't know how you grew up within Mormonism, but Brigham Young was it. There was nobody else. And so the amount of courage that took was remarkable to me. And I said that to Mike, and Mike said, you have no idea how difficult that was to get that published. And I believe he gave a great deal of credit to Charles Tate over that. And he can correct me if I'm wrong on that. I was lucky enough at a B.H. Roberts Society, Mike spoke, and I think this was about 91 or 92. And it was David Knowlton, Linda Cilito, and Mike at the B.H. Roberts Society. It was, that night was electric. Mike spoke about if you give the bad news of history, what happens to you. And Mike took that through from Joseph Smith up to that time in 91 or 92. It was ultimately published in Sunstone. Actually, all three papers, Linda's and David's, were all published. What was so fun was that I stayed at Lynn Whiteside's house, and Mike stayed at Lynn Whiteside's house. So guess who got to talk Mike's ear off for the next 3 days? That was me. We talked about the George Buchanan journals. And just a side note on that, the George Buchanan journals have recently been published by the Church Historians Press. 2.5 million words have now been made available. Well, Mike was the first to ever talk to me about that. And he had heard that Farms was going to publish it. And so we talked all about that and the implications of that and that there was a concern for redactions. Well, ultimately, there are redactions, and I gave a paper last year on that, on the George Buchanan, but the journals themselves, there's very little redactions right now, currently what's available. And the information that Mike told me about back then is all there. It's remarkable. And it'd be interesting to, you know, to know, with that all available now, how much different Mike would have written this book. Would he have added things? Is he fine with what he wrote? So that's an interesting thought. Just a side note, I think on that particular trip, I took Mike out to breakfast, and my son was along with me, and he was only about 4 or 5 years old. And I remember how gracious Mike was to this little 4 and 5 year old kid. And Benjamin ordered chocolate chip pancakes with whipped cream. And I remember Mike sitting there. And Mike said, well, I don't eat breakfast, but I eat lunch. And so he ordered his lunch, and then Benjamin had his chocolate chip pancakes, and I don't even remember what I had. I'm just going to stop there because on my personal relationship, but in reading Mike, and I think this comes through in this book, Wealth and Power, is that when I read Early Mormonism, The Magic Worldview, I read that about a year after it had come out. And I remember reading it, and I was a believing member of the church, an active. And I remember reading it and thinking, yeah, this makes complete sense. Joseph Smith putting the seer stone in his hand, translating the Book of Mormon, finding objects. It all made sense to me. It was a faithful history that was honest. And that was special. That was a very special event in my life. The same is true with New Plural Marriage, that after I read that, it was like, yeah, that's okay. You know, I get it. And as a believing Mormon, I can live with this. That's what Mike did. Now, I recall in one of our conversations we had, Mike said to me that he felt that that was a part of what he was supposed to do, was write history. In, again, that G. Homer Durham thing of Mike could answer, and that young woman at the Harris Fine Arts, that Mike could answer the tough questions. And I was talking to Brian Whitney about this session. He's next door in the author meets critic for the polygamy book, the section 132. But Brian said something very astute. He said that the beauty of wealth and power is that it is not an attack on the church. In fact, Mike has received a great deal of criticism because they see it as he's an apologist for the church in the way he wrote it. Now, I personally don't see that, and I'll get into that in just 1 second. But the Tribune's article discussed that, and Mike himself said that this is a very positive reflection of the church. And if we ever expect the church to finally open its books and allow us to see those tithing numbers that Mike's been attacked over in this book, and really get to see how much revenue is there through tithing, that it's going to take books like Wealth and Power to open those books up and see that. In the recent BYU study, I want to talk just a little bit about that. I think what Mike has always said, he goes, what I've written is the beginning, and now people can take it further. He said that over the other two hierarchy books. He said that over Magic World, New Plural Marriage. I mean, a good example is Carmen Hardy's Solemn Covenant. You know, Mike wrote New Plural Marriage. Carmen Hardy then comes out with Solemn Covenant. So Mike is a leader. He takes that and he makes it possible for other scholars to write about the subject. He's never been one to say, I'm the last word on this. So anyway, the new BYU studies that just came out has an interesting thing, and I could not find it in Mike's book, and if Mike says that it's in there, I'm sure it is. But it's a revelation, and I'd like to read the revelation. It's a Joseph Fielding Smith, Joseph F. Smith, but at the time he was Joseph Fielding Smith, called Joseph Fielding Smith. November 1st, 1918. Thus saith the Lord, I am well pleased with the records which are kept of the receipts and disbursements of the tithing and fast and free will offerings and properties of my church. And I say unto you that the time is now in accord with my word given to my servant Joseph Smith Jr. in 1838, when the tithing and other funds and the properties of my church shall be disposed of and appropriated for the work of the ministry and the building up and beautifying and the lengthening and strengthening of the stakes of Zion. The presidency of my church, the council of the 12, and not at any time less than a majority, shall be a quorum, and the presiding bishopric of my church shall be a council for this purpose. And they shall be agreed in their decisions, and shall hearken unto my voice in all things. And the duties of the presiding bishopric shall be in accordance with the promptings of my spirit, and subject to the presidency of the church. I had no idea this revelation even existed until Mike Marquardt pointed it out to me a few weeks ago. So it's interesting that we're getting more information. We're getting new information. Another example is the Mormon leaks when they discuss the $32 billion that is in securities. We're learning new things constantly. Part of that's the internet age. Part of that is because of the work Mike has done, such as Wealth and Power. One of the complaints has been about the tithing and where Mike gets his figures. I have no idea. That really wasn't that important to me. I didn't live or die on those numbers. What I found fascinating in this book was Heber J. Grant. Now, I read Ron Walker's article. It's called Crisis in Zion, Heber J. Grant and the Panic of 1893. It was published in the Arizona in the West, 1974, I think. Right, Mike?
Okay.
Anyway. What was interesting when I read that, and I probably read it in 88 or 89, was that here's Heber J. Grant going to the East. He's been sent on a mission to do that. And he makes these loans that in my head, and again, I'm not an economist, I'm not an accountant, but in my head, they seemed like really bad loans, just horrible loans. And in chapter 3, which is the chapter that blew my mind in this book, is Mike, and we've always, and Ron Walker tries to make it appear that way in this article, that Heber J. Grant was this amazing businessman. Now, maybe he was, again, because I'm not an expert in that, but it seemed like he failed at everything he touched, and it was the tithe payers who bailed him out every single time. I had no idea. And that's in chapter 3, and it's a remarkable chapter. All three chapters are really important chapters, but I found chapter 3 to be the one that blew my mind. I'm actually going to end because Christina and Mike have way more interesting things to talk about and are much more intelligent than I am. But I want to thank Mike for all that he's done.
Joe has this really great talent of hyping up things. So take it with a grain of salt. So I'm really grateful for the opportunity to get to speak on this book. After reading Rough Stone Rolling and developing an all-consuming interest in the Restoration, I read Mormonism and the Magic Worldview. It was the second book in Mormon studies I ever read, and it remains my favorite. If you haven't read it, you should. When I read that book, I never imagined a world where I would get to stand next to Mike and talk about his newest work. So to say this is an honor is an understatement. I remember when I first began ethnographic work in Mormonism. I would sit in the pews, and person after person would sit down next to me to teach me things that they thought I didn't know about the church. I know. Time and again, people would ask me whether I read the Book of Mormon, whether I had ever listened to General Conference, and if I was familiar with the Family Proclamation, and whether I knew if church leaders were unpaid. Of course, I knew the bishop at my ward was not paid. I had been to his office at BYU, and I knew his family. His wife was on the PTA, and I watched their oldest of six receive her young women's medallion during sacrament meeting. But I also knew that my leaders were unpaid. I'm Catholic, and my priest took a vow of poverty, so it didn't feel really special. It wasn't long after that that I learned the church leaders are paid. Sure, maybe not the bishop at the ward that works at BYU or the stake president, but as documents from Mormon leaks have shown, there are paid leaders of the church. And as Mike Quinn's newest book shows, there have been for quite some time. To use the language of Jonathan Stapley and John Butler, Mormonism reinstated a world where the heavens are open and scripture sacralizes the American landscape. Within this faith tradition, the temporal and spiritual are not only intimately connected, but the boundaries between the two are collapsed entirely. This is, in my mind, the greatest framework Quinn and the Mormon hierarchy, wealth and corporate power, could offer for the discussion of church finance. That Mormonism is a tradition that not only mingles the ordinary and the extraordinary, but also the spiritual and entrepreneurial. Quinn cites two outside authors who, speaking on the church in the 1980s, stated, "The wealth and power of Mormonism, in the end, came down to the essentials. The church is in the business of expanding the church, a temporal structure whose major goal is spiritual, the building of the kingdom of God on earth in preparation for the millennial reign of Jesus Christ." But this mingling is not without challenge. Much of this is because of the nature of the prophetic. As Quinn notes, if one accepted Joseph Smith's prophetic claims to the spiritual, they also had to accept his claims to the political, social, and economic. This in itself has noteworthy examples that challenged the saints and intrigues contemporary scholars: the Council of 50, the principle of plural celestial marriage, and the Kirtland Safety Society. The Mormon hierarchy, wealth, and corporate power closes out a series examining the interworkings of the LDS church leadership. Within the series, a lifetime of research, passion for history, and microfilm reels come together to offer insight into some of the most complicated and messy aspects of the contemporary church. To recap, his first book looks at the beginning of the movement that grew out of religious fervor, a time when waves of spiritual innovation flooded the Northeast United States and religion was democratized like never before. However, this democratization quickly turned with the death of the church's charismatic founder, a moment when the challenges of maintaining the hierarchy was brought to the forefront. It was through the forceful and managerial spirit of Brigham Young that the hierarchy succeeded. The first two decades examined by this book presents insight into the corporatization of Mormonism and how doctrinal insertion transformed the church from a place where sons and daughters prophesied, young men saw visions, and old men encountered the world of dreams, to a hierarchical structure intended to manage the power of God on earth. In his second work, Quinn delves deeper to offer an insider perspective on the modern church. By interviewing church aides, scouring the archive, and recalling his own history in the church historical department, Quinn offers perspective seldom offered in Mormon history. The book presents a reality that many assumed about the interworkings of the church and relationships among the leaders, that it is not always well in Zion. Disagreement and politics abound within the church. After all, it is run by men, powerful men, supported by the power of God. This leads to the newest volume, which again speaks of powerful men, this time economically powerful. As Quinn notes, the men of the hierarchy were not always economic powerhouses that owned booming businesses. There was a time when this was not something to aspire to. Rather, it was something to disparage. However, Mormon attitudes toward paid leadership shifted over time. But more than simple shifts, the position of the church has always been complicated, messy, and at times contradictory. There have been changes in personal wealth, business enterprise, and institutional finance within the Mormon hierarchy since 1830. Major shifts referenced in the volume include Joseph Smith's appointment to trustee in trust on January 30, 1841, the movement toward a fixed compensation for church leaders on October 12, 1877, and the replacement of the trustee in trust position to corporate soul in 1923. The greatest strength of this work, as with all the works of Quinn, is the in-depth research and unmatched skill in the archive. Throughout the text, a vast array of information is offered. At times, the sheer volume of information is overwhelming. If you've ever read Mike Quinn's work, that includes the 21 appendices in the book. At the same time, Quinn is upfront with the challenges of this type of research. Quinn notes that there are no current measures for salaries of top administrators in the church hierarchy or CEOs of the church's for-profit businesses. While this changed with the leak of President Eyring's pay stub, official declaration of salary remains unavailable. In addition, from the mid-20th century onward, Quinn could only find four references by LDS publishers to general authority salaries. Again, information regarding the income of the top leaders of the church is scarce. The final challenge to this kind of research may be the most obvious, that the church is under no legal obligation to disclose financial statements. However, information was gauged using itemized income statements for other countries that do require this. Of these, Canadian compensation of church employees offers the best comparative. On this note, one of the things that particularly interested me that Mike notes and that caught me off guard as something that I had never considered was the framing of missionaries as unpaid employees. These individuals fulfill clerical positions, administrative tasks, and blue-collar labor for the church. Quinn writes, "The importance of these unpaid missionaries as staff employees cannot be overstated. For instance, during 2010, there were 12,813 church service missionaries working as unpaid employees in various capacities. Considering the efforts of headquarters to recruit people with established skills and work experiences, CSMs probably saved the church $1 billion in salaries and benefits in 2010. These people are the backbone of the church organization, and they do not receive a salary or benefits of a standard employee, reducing cost to the organization." As many in the room probably know, last May, MormonLeaks released information connecting the church to $32 billion in U.S. corporate investments. For reference, my own people, the Roman Catholic Church, holds $7.5 billion in similar markets. This connection came through researching 13 LLCs through Form 13F, forms specific for institutional investment managers with over $100 million in assets. This research found stock holdings connected to domain names registered to Intellectual Reserve, Inc., the organization that holds the church's intellectual property. Importantly, to consider, as a note on that, Sam Brunson mentioned in from by common consent mentioned in his write-up that the information does not necessarily tell us who invested in the LLCs. The church might be the sole owner, they might not, but regardless, it must be noted that the church holds $32 billion in the stock market. Mike and I aren't technically here to make moral claims on the ethics of a tax-exempt organization investing funds donated by their people. But what I am interested in is how this relates to the years of research by Mike Quinn. In his chapter on the shift toward a corporate Mormonism, Quinn argues that corporate stocks and bonds constituted a partial bridge between the hierarchy's personal wealth and the church's institutional wealth. Stock ownership was a common link between general authorities and the businesses in which they served as officers or directors. But they are also bonds of kinship. And these businesses are vast. Quinn paints a picture of the scope of corporate Mormonism through a story of really anyone living in the Salt Lake Valley at any point from 1907 to 1932. In a normal day, this person might wake up and eat a bowl of cereal produced by Utah Cereal Food Company. He might have eaten it while reading the Deseret News before hopping on a streetcar powered by Utah Light and Traction Company to get to work at Gold Chain Mining, all businesses owned by the church. In a standard day, visiting these businesses and more, the normal person touched numerous companies in which general authorities served as officers or directors. Indeed, the boundary between the temporal and spiritual is very thin in the Salt Lake Valley. One of the things that is continually frustrating with Mike's work is that he doesn't make moral judgments on the state of the finances of the church. Rather, he's here to present a historical record and allow readers to draw their own conclusions. And many of these have been negative, as noted. To this reaction, Quinn wrote, "In my judgment, negative reactions would decrease significantly if LDS headquarters resumed a detailed financial report to each April's general conference. Such annual reporting could show how the billions in profits from the church's commercial investments make possible its worldwide ecclesiastical and humanitarian expenditures. In short, reaction to leaks, statements, and honestly Quinn's book would change with increased transparency, something I ask of my own church every day." Shifting gears, I want to make some comments on the author, just like Joe did. I remember my first day at the Church History Library. I was painfully nervous. I walked in and checked out my small microfilm reel, and I went to the computer and fumbled over it for longer than I would like to admit. I even put it in upside down, and the poor little old woman volunteer had to come over and help me. And then Mike walked into the reading room. He smiled at me and turned toward the hand crank microfilm machine, which I didn't think still existed. And it looked way more complicated than I would have been able to manage because I couldn't even figure out how to work the computer. The next day, I brought my copy of Mormonism and the Magic Worldview on the train in the hope that he would be there again to sign it. He was, and he continued to be there almost every day that summer. He signed my book and asked me about my research. A man whose book changed the way I viewed Mormonism and my own research asked me about my work. He might not remember this conversation, but I walked away from it no longer painfully afraid of that little room across from the temple in downtown Salt Lake City. I consider Mike Quinn to be one of the greatest historians that Mormon history or American religious history generally has ever seen. Mike made me believe in the power of history, the complexity of the people, and the magic of the past. And for that, I'm forever grateful.
Very generous. This has been an interesting experience. I appreciate very much the personal anecdotes that both have shared about our associations and their response to various publications that I have made. There's one thing that I anticipated that might be mentioned, although it was alluded to in kind of indirect ways, and that is that there has been a very negative response to this book by those who define themselves as ex-Mormons in various blogs on the internet. And I'm famously a semi-Luddite. I'm not online in my condo, and I use the internet only during the hours that public libraries allow me to. But after the book was published, I did do Google searches to see how people were responding to it. And what I found in reviews on Amazon and also on various blogs were that sometimes without looking at the book, but only based on comments in the Salt Lake Tribune in particular about the positive side of the book, various bloggers or critics, reviewers on a number of websites said that they'd lost all confidence in me as a historian because I had become an advocate for the church. The interesting thing is if they... What I do as a speaker, when I'm asked questions by the media or do a podcast with someone like John DeLynn or respond to inquiries by an author of another book who asks me my point of view, I will give my point of view and I'll make value judgments when asked for or when it seems that is appropriate. But as an author, I don't tell readers what to think. And so I have, as an author, devoted myself, perhaps with some exceptions, but for the most part, as a publishing author, I have laid out the evidence that I felt was both significant and relevant. And some significant evidence is not relevant to what you're writing about, and some relevant evidence to what you're writing about isn't significant. So, I've eliminated those areas, but the types of evidence that I thought was both significant and relevant to whatever topic I was writing about, whether it was in a book or an article or a chapter of a book, I've presented within context, and I've tried earnestly to provide the context of the times, of the culture, and of the attitudes of the people involved, whether they themselves were positive toward the developments that I have traced or negative. But I myself have tried very strenuously not to tell readers what to think. And so in this book, those who have read it, there are things in there that I think are negative, that are negative in relation to issues involving the use of church funds or the avoidance or payment of taxes by the church on its commercial properties and activities. But I don't say that what I think is positive or negative in the book. And my assumption is that people who read certain issues that I verify from the evidence that's available to me will think some of these things are stunningly positive, which I do, and myself, particularly the lack of profiteering by the leadership of the church from its commercial enterprises. I think that is stunningly positive. But I don't say that. I say it's stunning. And you can, as a reader, you can conclude it's either stunningly bad or stunningly good. And likewise with issues concerning payment of taxes, avoidance of taxes, whatever, I lay out the evidence that I have found that is relevant to this issue of church businesses and church income and church investments and policies involved in all of those issues. But I don't try to tell the reader what to think. And I think that many people in reading Origins of Power, which deals with sex and violence, and Extensions of Power, which in deals with controversy, disagreements, sex and violence, that people looked at my books who had a negative view to begin with of Mormonism, or were anticipating that, hoping that I would present that, and found what they were hoping for, and then praised me for giving them the kind of information they wanted. I did not dredge information up that I thought was sensational. I provided information, or dredged it up. I'll admit I'm a dredger. But I dredged up the information I thought was both relevant and significant. And if you regard it as positive or negative, that's your, as a reader, your decision. But people, in many cases, for example, Origins of Power, looked at my discussions of theocracy and violence in Pioneer, Utah, and saw that as my personal indictment of Mormonism, whereas I was presenting it as what the realities, as I understand them, were for Pioneer Mormonism in Utah and its theocracy. But in the chronology, I tried to dredge up every positive thing I could. Anyone who had, and in the biographies of the general authorities, I not only showed the times that they were arrested or accused of crimes, but when they proclaimed that they had seen visions. And in the chronology, I tried to present all the winners of the Pulitzer Prize and all of the positive, whether it's ice skating awards or downhill racing awards or whatever that I could find that, again, was a part of this reality of the Mormon culture and the activities that went beyond the hierarchy, which was why I created that chronology the way I did, was that I wanted to show readers the nature of Mormon culture and Mormons as a people beyond the emphasis that I had to make in the chapters and in the other appendices about the hierarchy, and that had been my major topic. But I wanted in the chronology to show a greater diversity. But again, I didn't tell readers that I think this is wonderful that Mormons have won the Pulitzer Prize for these books, some of which were negative about the LDS Church, or that it was a wonderful thing that there were various Mormons in the CEO position of various national corporations, beginning with George Romney in American Motors, and then the list of others that I had identified through my research. I just said these are prominent examples of Mormon activity. So in this book, Wealth and Corporate Power, there's something there for everybody. If you want something that you're going to be offended by, you will find it there. If there is something that you want to find inspiration in, as I did when I was researching and writing it, then you will. But I'm not going to tell you which I think is which. And I didn't in the book. And so I think that those who have become disillusioned with me as a historian because of the positive things I say that in interviews about corporate Mormonism. To some extent, that's my fault because I have made value judgments in my statements to the media. But in the book itself, I try not ever to tell people what to think. Having said that, I want to mention some oversights that were pointed out to me in some of my book talks that I gave, where I failed to make correlations that my data actually provided, but I failed to mention them. When I spoke to Weller Books, one woman in the audience asked, "You don't talk in the book anywhere about the percentage of church income that is given for management." And she said, "When I donate to a charity, I donate to charities only that have a low percentage of management costs that the internet now provides." And she said, "I'm suspicious that you didn't provide that information." Well, that was my oversight. The information is there. But I didn't emphasize it. I didn't point out that it's in the statistics, particularly in the appendices. So let me, and I'm going by memory now, but I'm pretty confident about these figures. In 1928, where I have a statement of not only income, but also expenditures at various levels in various departments and for various functions, I found that the amount in total for management costs of the LDS Church were 8% in 1928. And in the financial reports of the 1940s, where it was specified how much was spent in expenditures, the reports from 1916 onward, even though they were annually, they were only of expenditures. They didn't specify in those published reports the income. In 1915, they did, and the income equaled, or rather, the expenditures equaled the income. But it was only in that first annual report. But in the total expenditures, of those total expenditures in the 1940s, what I found was that they separated out what was paid for the allowances and the support of general authorities and the various functions of LDS headquarters. So they combined all of those into what we would call managerial costs or managerial expenses, 3% of total expenditures went to support both the general authorities and the entire bureaucracy at church headquarters. I think that if you're gauging whether the LDS Church is worthy of your donations for its charitable functions and services in relation to how much is spent for administrative costs, I think that in terms of the patterns that I could demonstrate from the 1920s to the 1950s and also from the international reports of income and expenditures in the United Kingdom, in Canada, in Australia, Tonga, and the Philippines, that they are at those same kinds of levels. Although within the international church there are discrepancies. For reasons I don't really understand, New Zealand has higher levels of expenditures for administration than any of the other countries that submit English language reports that I was able to examine. And for reasons I don't understand, that's an outlier in those respects. But in the other countries that did submit English language reports in the 21st century, the levels of percentage of expenditures that go toward administrative costs of salaries or clerical issues, the support of the various types of administration, are about the levels that I have already explained for the church as a whole during the years from the 1920s to the 1950s. The last financial report was 1959, published financial report. So there are oversights in the book, things that I could have emphasized and didn't. And one of them that I mentioned at a book signing and book talk that I did at Benchmark Books was the issue of lawsuits, which is a significant issue. I did not deal with that in a format that focused primarily or exclusively on lawsuits related to the finances or business activities of the LDS Church. And the reason for that, I mentioned individual lawsuits that involved the church for various reasons from various points of source from the mid-19th century to the late 20th century. But those were in the process of my discussing other projects or other topics. The reason I didn't emphasize that was simply because the data was not available to me. I know of no article even, and certainly no book, that focuses on this issue of litigation against the LDS Church. And the reason that it would be something that would be difficult to do in a even a paragraph or even a page form is that to do this in fairness to both the litigants on any civil case involving business and finance of the LDS Church, you would have to be able to identify the percentage of lawsuits that were dismissed by the judge as irrelevant or not meriting pursual in the courts. Then you would have to emphasize those for which the LDS Church settled out of court. Then you would have to emphasize those for which the LDS Church was the winner. And then you would have to emphasize, and that's just statistics, those in which the LDS Church was the loser. And you might, in terms of raw statistics, indicate what the average settlements were involved in each of those. But to be really fair to both sides of the litigation, you would have to indicate the nature of the lawsuits. What were the issues involved? And how did these come into various categories? Well, none of this is available to me. I have read over the years newspaper reports of lawsuits filed. I remember one, and some of you may remember this, of a orchard farmer in Utah County who filed a lawsuit against the LDS Church over what he claimed was practices that had destroyed his business of orchard raising. And the problem is that I saw the original report that there was such a lawsuit. But typically of newspaper reports, you know, it mentions only the high points and in some cases never the resolution of a case. So I didn't have, even on that one issue, a detailed account. And to mention only one issue and talk about it in detail and try to imply that it's representative of all lawsuits is something I wasn't willing to do. So there are oversights that others can work on that will go beyond what I did and improve what I did, perhaps revise my conclusions or expand them or reject them on the basis of other research. That's the nature of academic research and the nature of history. But other people can do it. I've done my bit, and I'm not returning to this topic again. So having said that, I appreciate the comments of the, and they were very kind, and I must emphasize that. And so I've mentioned some of the negative comments that I have received for this book online, for the most part online. But I do appreciate this opportunity to share this time with you, and now the rest is open for Q&A.
So we have 35 minutes. I have a feeling you probably should come up and line up. So if you're thinking you want to get in here, I would come down.
Two comments, the first for Christina and the second for Mike. Christina first. Long before Mormon Leaks released a pay stub from a general authority, a great deal was known about Mormon general authority salaries, much of it revealed by Mike over many articles and books over many, many years, much of it from the incredible Diaries of General Authorities series that Signature Books has put out. I've kept track over the years, and I have a, I think, 20, 30, 40-page paper of all of the comments on how much the various offices were paid. And it's never been out of line. It's never been outrageous. I think the current figure most people are quoting is $125,000 regardless of position. They're all paid the same. They all made way over that before they became a general authority. So anyway, I don't think this is new information that we should thank Mormon Leaks for. Secondly, to Mike. Mike, I've read every one of your books. I've read, I think, every one of your articles, including, I've at least perused every one of your footnotes, all 23 zillion of them.
Above and beyond the call of duty.
And I have to say, you are an amazing, incredible individual that is such a treasure to the church. They don't begin to realize what a service you have provided to everybody. Thank you, thank you, thank you for a lifetime of unbelievable research. And then the question, what next is in the pipeline? I can hardly wait. What comes next?
In answer to the question of what's next, I've pretty well decided not to agree to do any book reviews or any articles unless they're, and very often I've published things only because somebody asked me to do it and I hadn't thought of it until they asked me. But my intent is not to do anything further until I publish two books about post-manifesto polygamy. One book covering the period 1890 to 1906, where the marriages that were performed were primarily by church leaders who claimed church authority. And then the second volume from 1906 to 1925, which is primarily the rise of fundamentalism in the practice of polygamy and performance of ceremonies that did not claim the authority of the current first presidency. And I think, you know, if I continue to maintain my strength and mental acuity, that will be my next contribution.
Oh.
Years from now.
If you're not reading his footnotes, you're missing the good stuff. He sure has a lot of fascinating information buried in the footnote.
Thank you.
I just want to comment on the Mormon Leaks thing real quick. Mike has released information about the salaries of the church, but I think that seeing a pay stub from President Eyring was a big deal for a lot of people. And I think it's important to note that the figure that was released for President Eyring's pay was a base salary. It didn't include quite a bit of things. And $125,000 is a lot of money. For reference, my Pope makes zero. So I just want to note...
He has no expenses.
He doesn't. So That is true. But also neither does President Eyring, because he does have a housing allowance. So, and he has a lot of allowances, quite honestly. So I do think that that Mormon Leaks has done a great work for knowing the finances of the church. The two men behind Mormon Leaks are here. And I think they're doing incredible work for the sake of transparency, which I think is something we can all get behind, because people should know where their money goes. And I think nonprofits shouldn't be in the business of making money.
So I want to begin by asking your humble forgiveness, because I haven't read your book yet. Even the three chapters, I know I'm far behind. But I want to ask you something. This may cause you to make a value judgment you may not be comfortable with. But examining this from a more of a meta perspective, what is it that makes us all so weird when we talk about Mormon money, right? It seems like it's cultivated this culture where even bringing up the subject is a hard question, but every organization in the world requires money to operate. We all should be just understanding of that fact. Why is it such a weird topic to broach?
Well, there are a couple of approaches to that. One is that, like you say, every organization, like a family, and the family is an organization, requires money to come in, money to go out. And if there isn't enough money to come in to cover what has to go out, then there's a problem for that organization, whether it's a family or a business or a church organization or a charity. The discomfort of current Mormons to think about or have discussions about church finance, I think, is part of a secularization that has happened within the Mormon population. The Mormon theology makes it very clear that there is no distinction between the temporal and the spiritual. In Mormonism, Joseph Smith announced that as a revelation in 1830, in August of 1830, and it has been reemphasized in various ways since then, including in the Doctrine and Covenants, which has revelations about building a hotel, revelations about a tannery and a commercial enterprise, a store, various others, and John Taylor gave written, thus saith the Lord, revelations about gold mining. The Mormon experience in the 19th century, most Mormons accepted this without question. And those who did object to the commercialism of the LDS Church in many cases broke with Brigham Young over that issue, and in some cases closely aligned with church leadership for a period of years. They broke and formed what was called a new organization in the 1870s that eventually morphed into not only an economic critique, but a religious critique and schism. But for the vast majority of Mormons, there was no disturbance about talking about Mormon income, Mormon expenditures, because those were presented at every general conference in detail. The income, although not published, was announced in detail, dollars and cents, to every general conference in the 19th century up until 1884. And so in the 20th century, though, there has been a secularization of the Mormon population, primarily through the public school system, but also through media outlets that Mormons have adhered to. And so that Mormons today, in many cases, have adopted the secular views that church and finances are uncomfortable partners, and have adopted what is essentially a non-Mormon attitude toward business and finance as it relates to religion, where in the Mormon context there is no conflict. And Orson Hyde in 1866 or 67 stated that, he said, when it comes to dollars and cents, that to us is also spiritual. Well, for most Protestants and Catholics and Jews, this would be outrageous. And for secular Americans who perhaps have no religious affiliation, it's more than outrageous. It's unconstitutional. It's un-American. It's bad by any definition. But for Mormons, it shouldn't be. But I think that the discomfort that presently exists, that many of you may have from a negative point of view, but many rank-and-file Mormons who are devout have from a protective point of view, they do not want to discuss Mormon finances because they think it's irrelevant to the nature of the church, whereas it's really fundamental. And so I that would be my response to the question.
Well, Mike, as a fundamentalist Mormon, I was thrilled to hear that you're writing two more books on post-manifesto polygamy. It reminded me of the time when your 95-page article came out in spring of 85 in Dialogue, and I think I've talked to you about this, but I can't tell you how many fundamentalist Mormons were absolutely thrilled with the information in that book. I worked at Benchmark Books for a few decades, and it was amazing how many mainstream Mormons did not know that there were any marriages performed after the 1890 manifesto. And that also reminds me that when Todd Compton's book came out about the wives of Joseph Smith, and we had the book on the counter there at Benchmark, and many, many people came in and said, well, what's this book about? And it's about the wives of Joseph Smith. Oh, well, he didn't live polygamy. It was Brigham Young. So, I mean, I'm just so glad that the information's there if people want to read it. But I just wanted to thank you again. That was when I first really met you or knew about you, is when you wrote that Dialogue article. And I've read your book since then, and I just so appreciate what you've done, and I appreciate our friendship. And thanks again for all you've done.
I just want to make a small comment or an observation as a business executive, having spent 40 years in the Far East. I retired, as a vice president for the Walt Disney Company. And as most international business executives living overseas know and are concerned about, it's not about the base salary. That's a lovely thing. But, for example, 1 year, and I think in 1996, my base was low six figures, but my line seven was 600,000 or 700,000 because everything's in there. And when you're negotiating or moving company to company, it's all about the package. It is not about the base salary. So given that the senior executives for the church are international executives, for example, I don't know that one would ever be able to figure out what their true packages are, even if you get access to a base salary. And that's not going to be the most important thing.
Okay, I'll respond to that on at least two levels. One is the issue of base salary. And again, this is true that base salary is only a part of the picture, and in some cases with highly compensated executives, it may typically be really only the tip of the iceberg. But it's a starting point. In 2012... 2 years before the expansion of the uniform church salary to $125,000 for all general authorities, that occurred in 2014. In 2012, the CEO of the American Red Cross had a salary of $500,000. And 2 years later, the base salary, or as the preferred term at church headquarters, is living allowance for all general authorities, including the president of the LDS Church, was increased to $125,000. I think it's extraordinary, and I didn't emphasize this in the book, but I think it's extraordinary that the CEO of a church organization with billions of dollars of income and resources received less than one-fourth what the CEO of a charity received, when that CEO is made basically 8 to
to six job, and without emergency calls of significance, whereas the general authorities are 24/7 until they drop in the saddle, unless they are in one of the lesser quorums where their retirement occurs at 70. In terms of the additional allowances, I don't feel at liberty to mention this member of the Quorum of the Twelve's name, but a current living member of the Quorum of the Twelve, I've had conversations with two of his siblings, and they both commented that in accepting the position, he took a 40% loss in his annual income, and he lives in a home that he purchased with his own money, without any assistance, no living allowance or housing allowance from the LDS Church. And because of his reduced income, they said that, and I haven't been to the home, but they said he lives in a very modest home. And this is from the point of view of one of his brothers, who's in seven-figure wealth status as income, with house. At one point, he had a house that had 15,000 square feet. And so when he says that his brother is, the apostle is in a modest house, he's looking at it from a very high perspective, but I think that the other brother that I spoke to has a more moderate style, and he said the same thing to me. That's anecdotal. It isn't dollars and cents. It isn't something that I could compare. But I do think that from my personal knowledge of general authority allowances in the 1950s and 60s, some general authorities who were very wealthy accepted nothing from the LDS Church. If they got a check from the corporation of the president or the corporation of the presiding bishopric, they turned it into the missionary fund or the church welfare. They did not accept it on their own. In terms of benefits, most of the general authorities in the 1950s and 60s received free cars, but not from the LDS Church. They received them from wealthy car dealers, and you can think of some of the names. In the 1960s, it was a man named Garf, whose son and grandsons are now doing well in the same enterprise. My guess is that those, and again, those who had good incomes were not willing to accept ramblers for their car from local car dealers. And so they, in some cases, bought Lincoln Continentals or Cadillacs or our other cars on their own. I understand that a very wealthy member of the First Presidency, who's no longer in that position, drives a Mercedes-Benz, which is not provided to him by another, an outside company, or rather by the church, but is his own because he's wealthy. So you have these gives and takes that are involved in these additional compensations. But I think all told, it's still a remarkable image and a remarkable reality of men who are CEOs of an enterprise with billions of dollars of income a year, and which holds back billions of dollars of that income without expending it, and these men do not engage in profiteering.
Christian, can I, or Paul?
I just wanted to point out, it seems, Mike, that your negative critics are just upset that you disappointed them that the leaders of the church aren't as corrupt as they hoped.
I agree.
And yet, this year marks the 25th anniversary of our excommunication, and there is sufficient evidence that this corruption may exist in another form of silencing and infantilizing, if that's the right word, the membership of the church.
Yes, but in...
But in saying this, I do not like to use the word corruption. Because even though power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and I believe Lord Acton was dead right when he announced that more than a century ago, I think you also have to give a wide berth to good intentions that hurt other people. And I think in many cases the attitude that it is better that one or two suffer so that the group may prosper as a group is a motivation that is not corrupt, but it also does not follow Joseph's misinterpretation of the lost sheep, where he said that the real meaning of the parable of the lost sheep was that the one was worth risking the 99 to rescue the one.
So, just a quick question, Mike. A friend of mine asked me yesterday if I had ever heard that Harold B. Lee wanted to do away with Corporation Soul and go with a regular corporation. You have no... Okay, that was easy.
Thank you, Mike, for one more amazing book. So the question I came away from the book not sufficiently answered was what happened after Moyle to make sure that we never got another Moyle? Is it just that the church is too big one man can't just destroy the however many thousand corporations it has its finger in? Or are there actual policies in place that prevent that sort of recklessness and idiocy?
Okay, well, to step back, Henry D. Moyle is an example, I think, a tragic example of good intentions gone wrong. He felt that by expending the reserve fund, which is sometimes called a reserve fund, or the money that isn't spent on an annual basis to support the various activities of the church and expenditures, that using that to build up the church in terms of structures, in particular, building, by my experience, a stake center in Crawley, England, that could seat 1,600 people when the attendance of the Crawley branch was 75. And he was doing that on the for the anticipation of what the church membership would become if the inflated baptisms, which he didn't seem to recognize were inflated, continued in bringing in tithe-paying people. Well, in actual fact, they were not only inflated; they were baptizing children who couldn't, and poor children at that. In throughout the world, including industrialized countries like England and Germany and France, but also in poor countries or third world countries. And as a result, this building program in and of itself wiped out the reserve fund when he became in charge of the finances of the church in 1958. To 1963, in that five-year period, he wiped out the entire savings that his predecessor, J. Reuben Clark, had built up over a 25 to 30-year period. And by 1963, the financial officers of the church didn't think they'd be able to pay the payroll of church employees at church headquarters. That's how grim it was. At that point, N. Eldon Tanner was called in, and he was a millionaire on his own experience from Canada. He revised and revolutionized church finances. He put the church financial system on a corporate basis, which it had not been on before. He used very careful investment methods. And that from 1963 until his death in 1982, so for that period of time, almost 20 years, he implemented basically a resurrection of the LDS Church financially from that grim point where there was a question whether they could pay their secretaries in 1963, to a point where in the late 1960s and early 1970s, he told financial magazines in interviews that the church's commercial income was about half, nearly half, of what the church's annual income was. These methods that he has installed during that nearly 20-year period have continued, from my conversations with people at church headquarters, have continued to govern the LDS Church, not only at its central headquarters, but in all of its instructions to the financial officers throughout the world, in their investment policies, and many of them in whether it's UK stocks or businesses or Japanese or Filipino, they all have investment portfolios, and they invest, but only according to the specifications given to them by church headquarters. So, to answer your question, I think it's very unlikely that anyone will come along and challenge those procedures that have gone from the church barely being able to pay salaries of its employees in Salt Lake to a situation where I didn't mention this, and this is one of the oversights in the book, one evidence of the tremendous amount of income and also of reserve funds that the church has is during the Great Recession. Anyone remember that from 2007 to 2012? Every financial institution, no matter how conservative, in the United States took major hits. And in universities, we have actual reports of how much they lost as a result of their endowments through, and those endowments are conservatively invested. So the LDS Church undoubtedly took a hit. Whether it took a hit as great as Harvard and Yale and its endowments, no way to know that. But they undoubtedly took a hit. But during that period, from 2008 to 2012, were any of you asked to pay church budget in your wards or branches or stakes? Were any of you asked to pay the current living allowance for your, current cost of living for your missionaries in Paris or New York or Tokyo? No. Those financial revisions that benefited average members of the church in reducing their obligations to the church to basically nothing except tithing and fast offerings, which is not technically an obligation. It's simply a shifting of resources from a meal not consumed to help the poor. Those were not reversed. And then on the international level, including the developing world, where the financial reports in the 21st century from the Philippines, Tonga, showed that the church was paying and continues to pay 90 to 96, 97% of their expenditures. Church headquarters gives them subsidies because they're poor, generally poor members of the church cannot pay for those services that the church provides in these countries. That didn't reduce during the Great Recession. And so I think that is a twofold demonstration. One, that the church is very careful in its financial activities, and even during a period when all institutions have taken a hit in their, quote, reserve funds, which is the church term, or the university term could be endowment, investments, the LDS Church did not have to cut back on its benefits to the rank and file, both in the United States and outside the United States. And then again, the fact that there was no retrenchment by dumping back on the backs of rank-and-file Mormons these local costs of budget, building, et cetera, indicates that the church is utterly dedicated to the welfare of the LDS Church and its members throughout the world.
Hi, Mike. My name is Ethan Dodge, and I'm one of the men behind Mormon Leaks. And you've gotten a lot of praise today, and I just wanted to add to it. Thank you. I believe that information liberates, and your work in early Mormonism and magical worldview helped me gain a lot of perspective on my beliefs and ultimately helped me make the decision to leave the church, which has been obviously life-changing for me. And also, you are an inspiration to me in my work in Mormon League, so I just wanted to thank you.
Thank you. Although, that's not why I wrote those books.
One more, maybe?
Into the mic.
Please use the mic. Who
is really the chief financial officer of the church right now? How does it operate? Who makes the final decisions on where money goes, investment? I know theoretically it's the president of the church, but how is it the corporation really administered?
I can't answer that. I don't know the answer to that. But I had extensive interviews with the chief financial officer of the church from the mid-1960s to the mid-1980s. And he had independence. He was at one point, and his name is J. Allen Blodgett. He at one point was director of the entire financial department. And then the last 5 years of his service at church headquarters, he was the director of the investments department. And from what he told me, he had complete independence in making decisions, but those decisions were always subject to the advice and consent of N. Eldon Tanner, who was at that point the chief domo. And according to Blodgett and many other people that I spoke with, N. Eldon Tanner had a brain synapse issue that allowed him to keep all of these dollars and cents in mind. And he was able to do it, and he was the only one during that period of nearly 20 years who knew the entire picture, because there were not only investments that were handled by J. Allen Blodgett in the investment department at church headquarters. Every financial investment house in Manhattan had a church account, and those accounts were operated independent of church headquarters, just according to the, but following the guidelines. And the one of these return missionaries that handled these church accounts at each of these investment houses told me that the requirement from church headquarters was that a return missionary with a temple recommend had to be the only one to handle the church account at his own investment house, and the others that he knew about. And these were all, because they were similar kinds of people, they knew one another. But he told me the same thing is happening in Boston, in San Francisco, and this was in the early 1970s, with a highly compartmentalized system of investment. And according to everyone I talked to, the only one who knew the whole picture at the time was N. Eldon Tanner. Now, whether there is a single person who knows the entire financial picture now, I do not know. And who is the chief person who would review the reports that come in from all of the financial sub-directors, so to speak? I don't know that system. But I do know that from the evidence that I have, it is still highly compartmentalized. And, for example, the WikiLeaks or the Mormon leaks exposure of these $39 billion or so investments managed by various companies did not include the chief investment house of Utah, which is Ensign Peak Advisors. And the CEO of Ensign Peak Advisors told the Deseret News in a faith-promoting article that his company, Ensign Peak Advisors, handles billions of dollars in investments every day. And that was not included in the disclosures that Mormon Leaks were able to find. So the entire, my guess is that what they were able to disclose from their findings is a small percentage, very small, of the investment portfolio in total of the church, particularly if you include all of its investment houses throughout the world.
Thank you. Joe, Christina, all of you, your questions, and especially Mike Quinn. Thank you, brother.